most recently the author of Diamond Ruby. Joe, how are you doing?
I'm doing great.
First off, I wanted to ask you just a general question. You have taken these characters and they follow a rather tight historical timeline. And I'm wondering if a historical timeline, events in history, are a good guide for you in creating a narrative, or if you outline specific actions, or if history itself formed a kind of prism with which the characters were allowed to act along lines in the book.
That's a terrific question. And the answer is that I, for this specific book, I can't speak to how it's going to be in the future, but for this specific book, the year of 1923, when the body of the book is set, was a very specifically personal choice, because it was exactly the year that most would have made Ruby, my main character's life, completely eventful and fascinating and threatening. It was the year that Yankee Stadium opened. It was the year that Jack Dempsey, the great boxer, fought a championship fight in front of 125,000 people in the Polo Grounds that fall. It was the year the Coney Island Boardwalk opened. There were at least a dozen New York newspapers. If, in fact, you had somebody like Ruby, this girl with this odd baseball talent, then placing her in that year felt to me like putting her in a real world, and therefore all the things that happened to her felt like they would have happened if she had only existed at that time.
Yeah, but on some level you have to detract from a timeline, and so, and you certainly did in this book, and I'll get to specific nitpicking
sure.
later.
But, of course.
But I'm wondering if adhering to a timeline might also have certain disadvantages in the sense that you're always responding to history. How can characters breathe amidst these limitations, or do they breathe with these limitations?
You know what? To me, I can't speak for others, and I'll have to say that there is a feeling I often have when I'm reading historical fiction that it isn't breathing the way I would like it to, because it's too hamstrung by the mix of real and fictional. I can't speak to whether other people might feel that about my book, but it had the opposite effect on me. I spent weeks and weeks not reading secondary sources, but reading day by day through at least half a dozen New York newspapers that they have on microfilm at the main branch of the public library. And by the time I was done, I honestly felt, it might sound cliched, but I honestly felt like I was living inside that time period, because they were all covering the big news of the day, but they all were covering it from a different angle and a different perspective, and all bringing in stories that the others weren't covering. So by the time I had come through the fall of reading it, it felt like a real world, and therefore it allowed me to feel like my main character was a real person living in that world.
So the perspectives of specific newspapers permitted you to find new angles with the characters? How so?
Specifically, some were fascinated by the presence of the KKK as an active infiltrator of the police in Brooklyn at the time. Other newspapers didn't pay any attention to that. Some of them were fascinated by some of the more gruesome things that were going on there. They loved this sort of tabloid impression, so I learned some horrifying things about, you know, people living in sin, and I even included this in the book, some guy who stopped traffic because he thought he was the human fly until he got about five stories up, and then he wasn't anymore. Other ones would take a very, sort of anti-women's rights approach. It was a very, very strong time for women's rights in New York and nationwide, and others would be very strongly in favor, pretty much the way some of our many fewer newspapers now would be. And therefore, by getting these different perspectives, again, I felt like if I put a character that I felt like I was in touch with there, I could sort of see the different ways she would have been perceived at the time as opposed to at this time.
Yeah, but the letter that Ruby receives from the Ku Klux Klan is interesting, because actually it's impeccably spelled, which was something of a surprise, because every regrettable letter I've had the misfortune of looking at tends to be misspelled or very heavy on the K's. Why did you insist in this that they had impeccable spelling and grammar?
Well, I made that choice.
In their threats, you know?
Yes, I made that choice because, for a couple of reasons, because they were trying very hard to have a more populist attitude at the time. It was a more populist movement there at the time, and they were trying for a level of acceptance that they hadn't really cared about before. And though, of course, the book is fictional.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously it's fictional, and therefore there are things in there that might not have been how they actually happened. there was a very strong sense that what the KK wanted was to continue its attitudes, but do it in a more palatable way. They were running for elections and winning elections, even as far north as Maine, and they were therefore trying really hard to not be seen the same way they were before. They're still going to threaten, they're still going to live up to their standards of what they believed in, but for them to be working with somebody who could help them with their spelling, I mean, or for them not to glory in how they spell differently was something I decided to do based on what I'd read at the time.
Well, they also had a baseball team, I understand. Why didn't you go down that route? I'm curious.
Because, yes, and I, in fact, heard about that, though. I have to say that I was well along in the writing of this before I understood that. Because, you know, you probably hear this from a lot of authors, it was such an amazingly rich time that there's an awful lot of things. Don't tell anybody else, but my initial first draft of this book was 220,000 words long, and it ends up about 130. And the version I handed in to my agent was just a few thousand longer than the final version. So I had to do an enormous amount of cutting of things that I loved. I don't know about every writer, but I never fell into this trap before of saying, only include the things that are really important, not the things that are just cool. There were all sorts of things that were just cool that ended up in the first draft that I then looked and said, these don't work for the book. I just loved having them, so I wanted to include them. So I had to be, for such a big book as this, I had to be kind of draconian at cutting out things. And something like a KKK baseball team, however fascinating, would have sent the book off of what's already kind of a complicated arc.
Well, this also leads me to wonder, why do you think you're such a big gushing writer? I mean, 220,000 words, that's one protracted draft. I mean, you're setting yourself up to drown babies.
Yes, it's true. Well, I found out, for example, that that not only did Cary Grant work on the Coney Island boardwalk the same summer that I had Ruby working there, but that they very likely would have met because he worked walking around on stilts on the boardwalk, advertising Steeplechase Park, and I read in one, I think, unpublished memoir of his that I found, you know, sections of online, I think that's where it was from, that he was consistently being knocked over by the kids because they would grab a cane by somebody was using, run, hook him by the stilt, and then he'd stagger and fall. And so I set up him meeting Ruby, and then I set up a whole series of scenes where they became good friends. His name wasn't Cary Grant. He wasn't famous. And then at a certain point, I looked and I thought, the only reason I have this guy in here is that it tickles me that Cary Grant was there and that they likely would have met. He was a good friend to Ruby at a time that she really didn't need to have good friends. The book demanded that she not have good friends. So what was he doing there? And so that was exactly the sort of thing that made me feel like, okay, I've put something in for the fun of it, not because it benefits the book. And there were many, many things like that that didn't even make it into the first draft because they would have confused the issue or just made the book too ungainly.
Billy Sunday, was he in this initial draft? I was really shocked that he wasn't in this book. I mean, he was a pivotal figure. Here you have a plot that deals with bootlegging and baseball, and here was a baseball player turned prohibition evangelist.
Oh, I've written about him many times. Rightly or wrongly, I never considered including him because he's kind of, I was almost going to say too famous, but it's not that he's too famous because he's not more famous than, for example, Judge Landis, who's a presence in the book. The question is, how many villains that take a similar tack can you have in one book without it interfering? I mean, as you know from having read it, Ruby has to contend with a whole series of different people, all kind of at the same time at the end of the book, who are coming at her from different directions. Someone who exploit her, some hate her for one reason, some don't want her to play baseball. Billy Sunday was going, to me, to be repetitive of sort of a mix of those people, and therefore sort of for the, you know, I'm going to say purity, but this book, I don't know if any book is, but this book certainly isn't pure. But from my sense of the flow of the book, he was going to be a complication unless I brought him in as a cameo. And I was really, really determined not to speckle my book with real life characters who are only there for the purpose of my saying, hey, look, he's there,
yeah.
And hey, look, he's there. So either Billy Sunday or somebody like him was going to have to be an extremely important character, or he wasn't going to be in there at all.
And yet, by including Judge Landis, Jack Dempsey, Babe Ruth, a Helen Keller-like character, you do run this risk of, hey, who's the name? It's like the Love Boat, basically.
Well, you know what? But it's very similar to me as the way I felt about the baseball games, the baseball sections of the book. They have to be there. They're very important to it. But I never wanted to write one that was didn't have something else going on at the same time. At no point is there a baseball game where the only purpose is to wonder who's going to win or who's going to lose. There's always something else going on, whether it's the way Ruby's being treated by the other team, or whether it's the way Ruby's being treated by her own team, or it's whether it's the game she's being forced to do things she doesn't want to do. I felt that I only wanted to include real-life characters, especially in any important way, if, A, two things, she would have met them. And if somebody like Ruby had existed in 1923, it's extremely likely that Babe Ruth would have been very interested in her. And second, same with Jack Dempsey, because he was around all the time, and he and Ruth were together all the time, and the press always wanted to find them together. And or, if, as in the case of somebody like Landis, where the historical precedent was that even though the inspiration for Ruby was pitching in Tennessee, he was infuriated enough that he felt the need to make a declaration. Somebody like Ruby pitching in New York would have completely gained his attention. So I felt like I could include those, but that if I included too many others, that it would be falling into exactly the problem, you know, that would, because I felt like I could convey those in a realistic way that was believable, at least, you know, for I hoped it would be, but that the minute it was more than that, it was going to be show-offy.
Yeah.
That was my decision.
Is this why you made the family so bountiful? You know, the family has so many characters and threads, and early on, and of course, many of them die off early on, thankfully, so we can track everybody,
right.
But I'm curious if the having such a large family was a way to counterpoint all of these cameo appearances, or more than cameo appearances, walk-ons.
You know what? This is one of those things that I believe deeply, even if it might sound a little bit crass. I really, really wrote this book to write about the power of what the need to protect the people you love will allow you to do. It was so important to me that Ruby not be the smartest or flashiest or most talkative or person in the room. I was worried in a big book that is entirely from her point of view. It's third person, but it is a limited third person. Everything is seen from through her eyes in this book. Will people want to follow her for the length of the book if she's not the person who immediately marches into a room and everybody goes ooh and ah? If her greatest strength is twofold. One is threefold. She's underestimated, because women are underestimated, teenagers are underestimated, somebody who does things that aren't expected tend to be underestimated, and secondly, that she never stops working. She never, you know, people will say to her, you're going to do what we tell you, and she'll say, she won't give anything away, and then instantly her thoughts will be, okay, what do I do about this? What do I do about this? Therefore, in order for her to be that person who will do anything and never stop working to protect the one she loved, I had to set up a scenario where she comes out of a big, warm, loving family, so it is believable when she then will do whatever it takes to protect her nieces and, you know, sort of in the memory of the people that she loved who weren't with her anymore. So as I said, in that way, I've never thought of myself as being old-fashioned, but I've written something that I recognized as I went along might be old-fashioned. And what's your book about? Is it about baseball? No, it's about the power of familial love. But to a degree, that's what it feels like it's about.
Yeah. I'm wondering if you took any particular glee or pleasure in presenting Ruby with a series of remarkable tragedies and violence and the like. As author, sort of took us. Well, you're a very, very optimistic and cheerful man, from what I can say here.
Well, I guess, thank you. But the answer to that is that the influenza epidemic, which plays a large part in several chapters and obviously sets Ruby on the course that she has to take the rest of the book, I had known about it, I had heard the numbers, but it wasn't until I read through, again, many newspapers through that period in the summer and fall of 1918 that I understood the absolute toll it took, that in a weird way has been forgotten, because now all people kind of tend to think about are the numbers, that there were families. Yes, Ruby's family in the book is unluckier than many, because many families weren't hit that as hard as hers were, but many were. And a lot of the details, all of the details, are things that, that really happened. The, you know, the cemeteries with coffins piled a dozen high all around because there's nobody left there to dig the graves, things like that. And it was being reported in the newspaper every day. And it felt to me like it was really hard to write a story set just a few years later and then pretend that so much of what was going on during that period of the Roaring Twenties was in reaction to two things. First of all, World War One, and secondly, and relatedly, the influenza epidemic, and therefore to sort of set it in that period of time without showing that that period of time would never have been the way it was without those things felt fraudulent to me. And then, yes, I admit, you know, I turned the, you know, I treated Ruby and her family pretty harshly in order to set Ruby on that course, but it felt to me realistic based on what I was reading from the time.
Squirrel eating, this was one of the aspects of that.
You know what? I love stuff like this.
Because you have first-hand experience then.
No, and not. I don't have as good an arm. But in doing one of my baseball nonfiction books, which I've done several of, I found half a dozen, maybe it was four or five, several baseball players, mostly pitchers, who grew up, usually in tiny country towns or rurally, being the from the age of six or seven, being the chief hunters for their families because they had the ability to pick up a stone and knock a dove out of a tree. And the repeated thing from each one of those people was, and it didn't even occur to me until I was 11 years old, that everybody couldn't do that. In other words, their families looked at them from remarkably young ages and said, oh my goodness, can you hit that thing? And the kid says, sure. And that's when they first discovered. And that fact, which I never would have guessed, stuck in my head all these years. So then when I was plotting out Diamond Ruby, it was like, well, if this is something that helped people discover they could throw, then why not have it be something that someone who has to depend on it to live uses? Because that's how it worked for in real life.
You know, in Mark Kurlansky's Food of a Younger Land, which is a collection of Federal Writers Project food-related writings, there is a recipe in there for squirrels.
And in fact, it was a cookbook that I used, the Marion Harlan cookbook, the real cookbook, which had seven or eight squirrel recipes in it. And so, and well, mostly stew. I think squirrel was not an easy thing to eat. You usually had to cook it for a long time to soften it up. But there were in this cookbook that would have, you know, the fanciest desserts. There were also a bunch of squirrel recipes, and that book was written about this, you know, early in the century. So I felt like I was in pretty good, grounds for including that.
I wanted to go back to the Spanish flu epidemic. Mm. Obviously, it's extremely difficult to find anybody who is still alive who lived through that. And you tell me that you went through newspapers. How then can you recreate something if you only have a newspaper report to go by? Did you rely on any oral testimonies or anything along those lines too? I mean, you have to portray the way these people live, and newspapers don't always do it.
No, you know, that's absolutely true. And I also read, it's funny, I sort of turn around and look at it sort of from a different point of view. I had read, because I've done a bunch of medical writing, and I've written about respiratory diseases. I never wrote anything extensive about the flu, as opposed to it as part of sort of a spectrum of diseases that people were fighting. But I felt like I was fairly comfortable with the science of it as somebody who's done a fair amount of medical writing. In an odd way, I would have preferred to go back to the accounts being written at the time by people who were there, which was frequently what the newspaper articles were about, because a lot of them were just sort of news stories, but a lot of them weren't. A lot of them were sort of detailed descriptions from people, you know, not oral histories as much, rather than read what people were saying 30 or 40 years later based on their memories. I'm the same way with the baseball, when I do baseball writing, historical baseball writing, that I would rather have a report from the day after, even if it's a newspaper report, than the story being told by the old-timer who has told the story 9 million times, and the story is frequently inaccurate in a way because it's become a much better story over the course of years. And secondly, the juice has been drained out of it. So my feeling about going back and recapturing in my own mind for a work of fiction the way things felt at the time was based on the sort of reports where people almost felt like there was almost a panic-stricken sense of it, you know, like that was coming through even from the reporters, because they were living in and among it as well.
Yeah.
So it did feel real enough that I could then build, as I said, a fictional. I mean, there's one scene set at a candy shop, and that's completely created based on what seemed like a logical step that would have been something Ruby would have seen, and that's how I kind of tried to mix the real with the created.
On the other hand, I have a bone to pick with you about Eskimo pies. You have Eskimo pies in 1923, but as I understand it, the Eskimo Pie Company had only just been set up in 1921 in Iowa. How then did the Eskimo pies get to New York by the,
That could be a mistake. I was pretty careful, because I spent an awful lot of time looking up where things were and when they got national distribution. I can't tell you now that I check that, because I don't remember that specific. I can tell you that I had a bunch of really exciting candies and cookies and stuff that I wanted to include that I was then deeply disappointed to find out hadn't gotten the sort of distribution that that would have allowed them to be in New York at the time. I'd like to believe, therefore, that I looked and saw that as of early in 1923, Eskimo pies were available in New York, but I can't swear that that's in fact the case.
You didn't go through the New York Times archive for Eskimo pie as
no.
a keyword search. Certainly someone would have mentioned it in the New York newspaper.
Yes, maybe
no,
so.
No fact-checking here.
No, you know I did a ton of fact-checking. In fact, you know from having read the book that one of the characters, one of Ruby's nieces, collects candy wrappers that people bring her from all different cities. And that actually is a small sort of turn in the plot that uses one of the candy wrappers. What I was doing at the time was understanding, based on books I'd read, as well as other sources, that it was an incredible booming time for candies, but it was, as you brought up with Eskimo pies, it was extremely regional, and that very, that you might find the greatest candy that you would love to include in a book, and then discover, as you said, it was just in Iowa, and I spent a lot of time tracking where candies came from and what time when they got the distribution and when somebody new bought them and grew them wide. But I can't speak for Eskimo pies in that way.
Yeah. Well, also, you're going to have to keep them frozen as well if they're being made or melted. The chocolate is melted over. But anyway, that actually leads me to also ask about the gauze bandage that Ruby wears instead of a bra. Now, bras, of course, reached mass commercial production in the 1930s.
Right.
But there were still corsets. And if she truly wanted to prevent herself from, as you indicate, men's wandering hands, why did she opt for the gauze bandage as opposed to the corset? I mean, certainly the corset would have done the job, if not probably more effectively.
Yes, that's very possible. Two reasons. One is that they were more expensive. The second reason was that it wasn't fashion. It's just what women wore at the time. In other words, it was cheap, it was easy to get, and corsets were more expensive. They often required somebody else to do. Somebody like Ruby, who wanted to have the easiest possible way of keeping herself as unnoticeable as possible, would have used, in my belief, and it was certainly very widely used, the sort of gauze I've not something I knew before I started researching this book, that was something that was widely used, but it was.
Yeah. Radar guns were introduced in 1935 to measure a baseball's speed. Before that, you had speed machines, which were increasingly rare. And as I understand it, there's extremely little recorded information on pre-radar speed machines. In this book, Ruby looks at the machine in question, and you write, "To be honest, she couldn't make head or tail of it." This leads me to believe that there was some guesswork or confabulation upon your part.
No, the only thing I didn't know was exactly what... It's a great question. In 1913, Baseball Magazine decided that they wanted to figure out how fast Walter Johnson and... Nat Rucker? I can't remember another pitcher, but Walter Johnson pitched. But of course, that wasn't so easy to do in 1913. So they went, in fact, as the book says, they went to the Remington Arms Company, and they said, "Help us out. We want to be able to do this." The Remington Arms Company, in fact, had a device for measuring the speed that bullets flew that was exactly the way I described the speed machine here. Baseball Magazine in fact, this is all completely accurate. Another one of those things I found for a nonfiction book and loved and said, oh, I have to be able to use this somehow. They ended up doing a 15-page article that that described this and photographed the wire mesh that you had to throw the ball through. It was the simplest thing. You'd throw a baseball, it would brush through the mesh, which would register on this device. It would then hit a steel plate that was also wired to the device. They had the ability then to calculate the amount of time in between, and they knew the distance, and they could figure out how fast the ball was going. So they did this article. It was really, really hard for Walter Johnson, who was incredibly fast and incredibly accurate, to throw the ball through the wire mesh. The only thing I changed from the original was that I made the mesh, the screen that Ruby and the people who were throwing the ball against her had to throw through, bigger, because if Walter Johnson had trouble getting it through, it would be really unfair to anybody other than Ruby. It was a wonderful article, and my favorite thing about it is that when I was researching the book, I went to the Remington Company and I said, tell me more. And the Remington Company said, we have never heard of this. We believe it exists. Here's a historical forum where people talk about Remington's history. Go to it. And I went to it, and I posted, and I asked a bunch of questions about it, and people were so fascinated, and they'd seen the article, but there was none of them still exists. Like, in other words, it's a lost part of the Remington Arms Company's history that they used to measure the speed of bullets.
They don't
in
keep
this
very
way.
Good records.
They must not. Yeah. I was very disappointed. And so the answer is that it's completely accurate. The only thing that wasn't accurate, other than the size of the mesh, was the fact that the photographs of the machine itself don't take you into the inner workings. So everything is accurate, except I couldn't describe how it worked inside.
Yeah.
Because that wasn't there. I probably would not have been able to write the entire Coney Island part. This book, if there's one article that's the most important thing to this entire book, it's the fact that in 1913, Baseball Magazine was smart enough to, and then in fact, the same year, they decided to look into whether length of arms actually increased how fast you were. And there was a long article with all of these shots of, again, Walter Johnson, who had very long arms, standing there shirtless as they measured his wingspan versus other pitchers' wingspan. So Baseball Magazine was this remarkably forward-thinking and clever magazine back in the 19-teens.
Very conceptual, it sounds like.
Exactly. Yeah. And extremely helpful to a writer like me who needed both long arms and the speed machine to make their book work.
Well, this also leads me to wonder, I mean, you based Ruby on Jackie Mitchell, but Mitchell had Dazzy Vance to teach her how to pitch, and also attended an Atlanta baseball school. Ruby, by contrast, is almost an autodidactic. She starts pitching, and there you go. But this leads me to wonder, isn't there a risk in credibility here? Because you may have the long arms, you may have the ability to pitch, but that needs to be trained in some sense. And so I'm wondering how well you wrestled with this.
Well, you know what? I mean, that's the first question you've asked of me to which my answer has to be that I chose to do it that way because it's a work of fiction and either trusted or hoped that people would go along for the ride. And there's no question that it is more tall tale-ish to have somebody who, regardless of the fact that they have to throw the ball, you know, not to mention, you know, throwing rocks at squirrels, but they have to throw the ball so many hundreds of times that there's a certain amount of training involved in terms of accuracy and in terms of speed, as long as you don't hurt yourself, that she goes through when she's in, you know, in Coney Island. But there's also I made the purposeful decision to say you either believe this, given that there are a fair number of baseball pitchers who came up from small towns and were hired and just were thrown into it and got by for a long time just with the ability to throw the ball really hard, that you would believe that there could be a girl in a situation who could be the same way.
Yeah. Well, this also leads me to wonder, I'm glad you mentioned tall tale, because there are a couple instances in which you use similes in a way that really expands them, and I'm curious about this. I'll cite two examples. The entire room was as hot as if someone had brought a wood-burning stove inside. And then there's another one later on. By the end of the week, she felt like a clockwork girl made of gears and pulleys and levers. So you have an additional detail that reinforces the detail you've already introduced, the wood-burning stove brought inside versus just a wood-burning stove, the gears and pulleys listed when you've already established the Clockwork Girl comparison. So I'm wondering if this was an effort to mimic a particular writing style of the 1920s, or whether you were trying to fulfill this narrative on a language basis within the tall tale aspect, or whatever.
You know what? That's a really good question, because I hadn't really thought about that. There was definitely an effort, which I thought was a lot of fun. I was going to say a real challenge, but it was a lot of fun to write in a way that didn't seem too contemporary, too of now, while not falling into the enormous pitfalls of sounding so studied and mannered in the way that so much writing from that era was, that there was a soberness of the prose that isn't typical of everything I write, that both reflected, I thought, Ruby's personality and the time she lived in, that some of this and some of the sort of longer phrases were conscious attempts. Some of it might well be, I wanted to make my point and hit you over the head with it. The Clockwork Girl one, I think. The wood stove one, I just probably just thought I liked the way the sentence, you know, sounded. The other one, I think it was like, no, all right, Clockwork Girl, you get it. No, really, really a Clockwork Girl. Like, okay, you might be saying, okay, we already get it, but I want to make sure that you understand that she feels like she's totally out of her own control, and that she's just been turned into a, you know, at least I didn't say a Clockwork Girl, an automaton, you know, a golem.
Laundry list kind of thing.
Exactly. But I do think that some of the phrasing throughout the book was my attempt to have the sort of more serious side of Ruby reflected, as well as the sort of dignity that some of the prose then had, without falling over the line into it seeming, as I said, so mannered, as if I were trying to write from some point of view from there, as opposed to being somebody who's sitting here now writing about that time.
On the other hand, protracted similes do expand the word count, and as we established earlier in this conversation. So I'm wondering if you were kind of doomed to just write a long book.
Maybe. Though, you know what? I'm usually the last person to say that, oh, but look, the readers have loved it. The one thing that was a relief to me, from starting with my agent to my publisher to the people who've read it now, and people have had caveats and quibbles, and there have been some people out there who certainly haven't loved it, is the problems people have with it don't tend to be the length, because they think that it has the momentum that I hoped it had. The problems people have with it are, I guess, issues of believability or, you know, or not wanting to buy into it. But the length of it has not yet, it's early yet, but the length of it has not yet been something that people have complained about, because they feel like I've set up a believable enough world and enough at stake that it carries them through. So having done the cuts that I had to do after the first draft, I feel like that I didn't expand the length beyond what I wanted it to be. It feels tight to me even at that length, and therefore I'm very glad that I didn't hear the rule that said that first novels shouldn't be more than 90,000 words, which I've now heard many times from people who don't know my book, and I'm sitting there saying, oh, I'm really glad I didn't listen to you, because my book felt right at 120,000 or 130,000.
The newspaper articles in chapter 25, was the language lifted from real newspaper articles? Or?
Yeah, and there were originally, we're talking about writing more, there were originally three or four more of those little things, and my editor, that wasn't one of those things that I got rid of before my editor saw it. My editor said, you know, basically, you've made your point with two or three, and the answer is yes, that in those cases, those were taken very, not directly, obviously, because they were writing about something I made up, but the language, the hyperbole, you know, that was, I love reading that in the research I've done for my nonfiction baseball books, how purple the prose is. And so it was really, really fun for me, even briefly, to have the chance to sort of capture that.
There's a lot of press conferences in this book as well, a lot of journalist characters. I'm wondering if looking at so many newspapers made you journalism happy, essentially.
Yeah, you know, I think it did. And more so, they were just everywhere. I mean, there were so many newspapers, as I said, and they were so avid is the word for publicity, you know, for anything they could publicize, and they were so enthusiastically, I mean, they looked an awful lot like less cynical. I mean, I'm sure they were cynical. I didn't see as much of that from this point of view, but you know, members of the press like in His Girl Friday. You know, they're racing around and they're there and they're asking, you know, not necessarily tough questions, but at the same time, they are part of the story themselves because there's just so many of them around and they have so much news that they have to report. So I think probably discovering there were so many newspapers and reading so many of them probably made me want to include some journalists as characters.
I was also curious as the anti-alcohol stance of this book through the Nick character. I mean, this book was set during the early years of Prohibition, and yet reading this book, pretty much all the characters tiss tiss kiss their fingers against alcohol, when in fact at the time I'm reading Daniel Okrent's Last Call, so I feel compelled to ask this question about why this book is so seems rigid. All the characters seem rigidly against it.
I have only one real Prohibition agent who's a major character in the book, and he does get to have a little speech saying he thinks the law is ridiculous, but he's going to chase after it. Yeah. I never really thought of the book as being anti-alcohol. I think Ruby is not even anti-alcohol as much as she is like sort of horrified because what happened to her brother, which includes alcohol later, wasn't based on alcohol. Like, it's not that.
Yeah.
I do have one scene set in a speakeasy that's a pretty joyless place. So I guess you could interpret it that way, but I didn't really think of it when I was writing it. It's something, you know, there's I think the only other time alcohol's mentioned is the discussion that when the baseball players are coming, and some of the happiest moments in Ruby and her niece's lives are the brief times on Coney Island when there's sort of an all-night party with ballplayers coming and using the pitching machine. And there's a line or two in there about how they're always drinking from flasks that Ruby has never offered any of because they've obviously decided she's a girl. She's a teenager. She's not going to drink. So my feeling about that is that alcohol in that scenario isn't an evil. It's just something that people do. It's a party. Alcohol is only an awful thing in this book because of Prohibition, which leads it to being one of the sort of, you know, main things that gangsters use. And therefore, I hope I differentiate between the idea that drinking is evil in all cases and the idea that this law that made it an illegal thing and therefore led to enormous amounts of organized crime was an evil thing.
Maybe what I'm identifying here is Ruby having a very law-abiding nature tended to extend that law-abiding nature over the course of the book. So sometimes the book can be extremely, I suppose, law-abiding or very...
That's interesting.
Yeah, at least from my standpoint.
Because I didn't think when Ruby sees that her brother... You notice when Ruby sees that Nick is working for her feeling is, you know, this is trouble because he's going to get himself in trouble, but it isn't. Oh, how could it be alcohol? It's how can it be the sort of, you know, how is he going to make it through with these, you know, with the tough people who are likely to be the ones who are running? So anyway, it's interesting. I guess my feeling about Ruby with an awful lot of this, because boy, I mean, you haven't asked me about this yet, but people have already started to ask me. It's like, how come she doesn't have a romance? And I'm like, even in the course of this long book, Ruby doesn't have any time to do anything other than stay alive and protect the people around her and make it through. And there is no time for her to party, and there's no time for her to, you know, meet some nice teenage boy.
Well, it's funny because I actually appreciated the fact that she didn't really have much in the way of a romantic life, because every book we read of that time or written during that time, the woman inevitably runs off with some man, and here you have a situation in which that's not the case. So why I didn't ask.
Yes,
because I mean, to me, it's not even an issue.
I completely agree, but my answer to those people is fill me in on when it was that Ruby has the time for, you know, and I'm writing a follow-up book and it's not going to be filled with, you know, romance, but it's going to, part of the issue is, what does Ruby do when she doesn't have to wake up every morning trying to figure out how to survive? Like what impact does it leave on you when you're 17 and having to do that, when you're 21 and suddenly facing a world where you don't have those day-to-day challenges? But in the course of Diamond Ruby, I felt like she had to kind of be an arrow through the book. The book is this big book with lots of characters, but she has to be sort of an arrow through it. And at least in my opinion, the alcohol thing was just another distraction for her, you know, another thing to be overcome.
Well, I think speaking of overcoming things, you have overcome the Segunda experience. Joe, thanks very much for taking the time out. It was a pleasure chatting.
Oh, and with you too. Thanks.